Welcome to Intercultural Yoga. My name is Raymond Reyes and I'm the Associate Provost and Chief Diversity Officer at Gonzaga University. Before we start, I want to acknowledge that we are doing this program on Spokane tribal homelands and that Gonzaga is a settler institution on occupied lands of the Spokane tribe. And we're grateful to be here and understand that the mountains, the rivers, all things that are around us, the tree people, they all have a memory, an ancestral memory. And today, by acknowledging, we honor them. Why intercultural yoga? I want to mention this to you, Dr. Shelton, and I'll introduce you here in a little while, but this whole idea of intercultural yoga came about wanting to talk about things that make people uncomfortable, to stretch them, to get them out of their comfort zone, to be able to challenge people's assumptions. Because I think this, if we can challenge people's assumptions and it's uncomfortable, that's where new growth and development resides. That's the fertile ground by which people can expand their horizons and understand race relations or any kind of human difference differently. So intercultural yoga, beginning from the inside out. The other thing that inspired many of us to arrive at this title, intercultural yoga, had to do, and I just think about it like it happened yesterday, the last minutes of George Floyd, and I can't breathe, and then petitioning his mother at the very end. I can't ever forget what his last words. And so I want to dedicate everything that we do today in this conversation to him and his ancestors and his family. Dr. Charlita Shelton, somebody that I've known now almost a year, as I've often described you as a utility player, that you play many different positions and play them well in higher education. You've served as president, you've served as provost, chief diversity officer, you have served as a leader in higher education for many, many years. But also a fascinating part of your sacred story, the convergence of your biology and your biography is that you are an ex-Marine, and that your ancestral roots, your father, your mother, you grew up in a family on a farm. So you have a strong work ethic, and I know that from personal experience. And you introducing me to this phrase, key performance indicator. And if you want something done, give it to Dr. Shelton, she will get it done. So much so that our president appointed her to spearhead, coordinate our institutional pandemic strategic response. And that's a complex, multifaceted task that you've been asked to do, and you've done it quite well. I want to thank you for that. Today, we want to talk about something that's still fresh in our minds that happened over the Memorial Day weekend, almost 3 months ago now, it's hard to believe, the passing of George Floyd and how it happened, and how this country, it seems, is not going to go back to sleep. This is different. This is an extraordinary moment. And I want to talk a little bit more about how education can play a role in societal transformation and change, but most importantly, how all of a sudden the prominence of diversity, equity, and inclusion has become very strategically instrumental in higher education, and how that happened from we weren't on in the books earlier. We're talking about see Dick and Jane and learning how to read, and you and I as people of color, we didn't see ourselves in the curriculum. So all of a sudden we're invisible. And now we're more visible than ever, and the chief diversity officer is a key player at the president's table now. How did that happen?
Well, so first I would say it happened because oftentimes, just in this world we live in, is we tend to, as a people, we're reactionary. So you have the murder of George Floyd, you have the murder of so many other black Americans, and you have a crisis on your hand as a result of it. And so intellectually, we tell ourselves, especially if you're leading a higher education institution, if you're leaders within a higher education institution, that we need to begin working on our knowledge of race relations and our knowledge of what equity means and what inclusion means. And so it bubbles up. But if you go back historically, offices of diversities were created in business and industry and higher education as a result of affirmative action. But yet that was another problem, right? So we created this office because of a problem, affirmative action, you know, and ensuring this means for people of color that there is some type of level playing field in terms of, you know, gaining admittance into college or within, you know, in their own employment realm. And we can go on and on. The famous case, University of Michigan case, affirmative action, and that had to do with their entrance, their admissions policies, people of color. So yes, now, you know, take a look at Inside Higher Ed, take a look at the Chronicle, all of the mm-hmm. chief diversity officer positions that are, that institutions are now, you know, seeking. And it's because of where we are. But if institutions would take a proactive approach, which Gonzaga has, I mean, you've served, Raymond, not only, you know, for more than 32 years at the institution initially, of course, in the School of Education as a professor there, but then leading, you know, the Office of Diversity as a one-man band and show, 12, 13 years ago, and now, mm-hmm. of course, the creation of an office. And I've always appreciated the work Gonzaga, as a predominantly white institution, has supported around mm-hmm. DEI work. But now you do have institutions trying to reinvent themselves in terms of this work. And, you know, we've got riots going on and we've got demonstrations going on. And what are we going to do about that? It all having to do with, you know, systemic racism. So
what I'm interested in, get your thoughts on this. You've heard this before, the three imperatives and why institutions, whether it's corporate America or higher ed, to get involved with diversity, inclusion, and equity. And the three imperatives go like this, and you've heard it before. I distill it down. I have to, I need to, I want to. I have to is compliance, regulatory, Title VII, Title IX, ADA, the things that you earlier talked about. That's the I have to. The I need to is the economic business imperative, the browning of America demographically, you know, enrollment management, paying public, whether you're public or private institutions, it's an economic business imperative. The third one, though, I think, and this is the one that Martin Luther King talked about, this is, I think, African-American religious thought is grounded in it. I think that a lot of the indigenous leaders of the 60s were about this as well, and that is the moral and ethical imperative. Really looking at it, I want to do this, I need to do this, and it's the moral and ethical. How do we move people from reacting to staying out of bankruptcy by getting sued, which is the compliance piece, or the business economic imperative, which is about, you know, keeping the butts in the seats and keeping the tuition revenue flowing, whether it's state or otherwise private tuition, versus really looking at it in the case of the Jesuits in the Catholic tradition, seeing the other through God's eyes, that this is like the incarnational view, that we're doing this because it is the spiritual thing to do. It's what Jesus would do. It's what a Christian is about, or a Buddhist, or a Hindu, or somebody who prays with a pipe, you know, a different religious beliefs, but finding the moral, ethical imperative resident in their faith life, you know. And I'm just interested, as a person who's done CDO work, how do you move an institution as a president or as a CDO from I have to kind of avoid bad things from happening to being assertive and I want to, and being, I also use the word aggressive, strategically aggressive, in wanting to get stuff done?
Well, first of all, the individual has to be somewhat progressive in thought, in understanding that it becomes the win-win situation if they embrace diversity education, if they embrace the hiring of culturally diverse, historically underrepresented people, whether we're talking from a staff or faculty, that is going to make their organization, their institution, richer as a result of all of this. So they have to have it in their heart. I'm supporting, matter of fact, a small school. This very, very small school in San Diego, and it's interesting, the CEO, who has always had a passion for diversity, but a small school, and they have not actually created an office of diversity, but what she said to me that resonated, and I thought it was so interesting, she happens to be a white individual that grew up in Detroit, Michigan. So she essentially grew up around black folks. she grew up around people of color to get an understanding mm-hmm. of who they were and the plight, and understanding, you know, more than enough about systemic racism. So it was her passion around that cause that led her in an institution that she's now leading to care enough about, it's in the head, but it's in the heart, that something needs to change. And how can she be an agent of change? You oftentimes talk about using your power and privilege. How do you use your power and privilege to be an agent of change in some type of way? And that's what she's done. And that's what, and it all starts at the top, because if you have a president and a cabinet and a leadership team that simply, it's a non-issue to them, you're never going to see it. I've seen it in institutions where, they're not even recognizing that 40% of their student population is of color.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you take a look at the boardroom, as they say,
right.
And you take a look at their faculty, you take a look at their staff, not reflective of the students that they're serving.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I want to talk a little bit about a creative tension that the Black Lives Matter movement has, stimulated. And I think it's a positive activation, so to speak. And let me back up a little bit. The Jesuits are fond of believing that God's face is revealed in the tension. That you've heard this before, you lean into the tension and you don't want to resolve it, but you try to sit with it because that's where the sources of learning can occur. And the divine intelligence can prevail and not the human agenda. It goes like this, you've heard it before, but I think it's even amplified a little bit more now. When people talk about Black Lives Matter, I get that. Then you hear other communities of color say, well, what about us? It goes back to what happened in the early 60s about it's black or white. These issues are black or white, the binary, versus what about other communities of color, brown people, or other social identities, the idea of what about gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, what about women, men, female, that binary, what about language, national origin, social class, and all the different social identities that make us different. How do we reconcile divorcing the movement of justice and inclusion in that context when we're focusing on Black Lives Matter, knowing the historical legacy of racism in this country and understanding profoundly why it's important to focus on Black Lives Matter? And I don't think it has to be an either or proposition, it can be in both, particularly when we look at critical race theory, understanding of interest convergence. How can like white allies, other communities of color, and other social identities have been marginalized and oppressed come to the table to support Black Lives Matter? Can you give any insights or any things that you've thought about in regard to this tension, this critique that it's not often I hear it, but I hear it every once in a while.
Well, there was always going to be a tension. It'll be a tension within the community. Let's take a look at Malcolm X and Martin Luther King.
Yeah, yeah,
that was a bit of a tension, right?
Yeah.
Radical tension between the two, violence versus nonviolence. And of course, Malcolm X came around, that important trip to Mecca and whatnot. And so the tension in terms of BIPOC people and the focus on right now, Black Lives Matter, or the focus on Black Americans and systemic racism, I would say even having that conversation in and of itself will help to support other people of color. Because we're really all in this together, so maybe there's not a focus on Native people, or there's not a focus on Latinx people right now, although there was the focus because of, dealing with all of the issues of non-documented immigrants, for instance. But I would say that, history oftentimes have repeated itself again in terms of these various tensions. So the LGBTQ people will tell you, well, my goodness, we gave up the month of June for Black Lives Matter, because think about it, June was LGBTQ month. And not to make light of that, but they said, you didn't hear us complaining about that when Black Lives Matter came up, because it's timing. It's all about timing. And the timing right now is the current focus, right? That's the current focus.
No,
but it doesn't negate you know, other people of color, and of course striving for some level of equality, but it's timing.
It is timing, and it's busting up the binary, because that's the double bind. That's the ways in which people are controlled, either or, rather than and both, or look really spread it out differently, or looking for the common ground. What do we have in interest convergence? What do we have in common? One of the things that I wrote something down here, and the next level of evolution in race relations seems to be deconstructing the notion that this is then against white people. Mm-hmm. And you've heard this before, so, you know, it's a trite axiom we've heard, separate the sin from the sinner.
Yes.
You know, separate the behavior, even as a parent, you know, separating the behavior from the parent, from the child,
right.
You know, in your parenting practice. Easier said than done sometimes, right? But it's an important discernment to make. And so as we move, you know, without denying white fragility, because I think white fragility needs to be confronted, needs to be faced. So realizing that's the storm that one has to go through, there still is this issue again about, this is not about against white people. This is about white structures, white supremacy. This is about structures and systems. And I know that human beings built those systems, but there's an historical legacy, it's a cumulative effect of hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of years of practice of how to exclude people based on some human difference. I mean, we're masterful at that. But just what is it gonna take for the coalition building and the solidarity movement to take a certain position where white people feel safe that it isn't about against a whiteness? That whiteness doesn't become a pejorative. That like Pablo Freire says, the oppressed don't become the oppressor. How can we interrupt that? Any ideas around that?
Well, for folks to be educated. So for a white person to understand what privilege means and what fragility means in and of itself, for them to have the basic education, even if they have the basic education, and I always say, you know, there's a lot of talk around the sophistication in diversity, equity, and inclusion work relative to where individuals should be educated up here, especially in academic institutions, because everyone is up here. No, you have to start with the basics. The basics are the four dimensions of diversity. And you know this well. It begins with the self. I don't care who you are, I don't care your color. It begins with you. Where were you raised? Who were you raised by? Who did you interact with? It begins with the self, your values and your principles in differences. And then it spans to what you can see, which are people of color, for instance, which happens to be gender. And then it goes beyond that if you happen to be LGBTQ, and then it goes to religion. Then it's class structure. If you have even the basic understanding of that as a white individual, anyone, I'd say, we talk about, if for a moment, we've talked about often, I don't care if you're a person of color or not, it doesn't mean you're interculturally competent.
Right, right.
Doesn't mean it.
No,
but you have to start with yourself first. Yeah. And then a basic understanding of what we try to, you know, to instill and teach here at Gonzaga. White fragility, white privilege, microaggression, unconscious bias. What does all of that mean? Understanding a little bit about the history, that's the white paper I told you I wrote about, which had to do with the history of policing or law enforcement in the black community.
Right.
So for police officers to understand where we are today, now with attitudes about them, they have to understand where this started and how it started. Slavery.
No, you're right.
Gathering up those slaves, deputizing, gonna send them back to the plantation. So yeah, it's education and then understanding
of all of this. You hit it right on. I mean, I think in previous programs, forever, I've often talked about this Carl Rogers notion of what you forget, you always are, what you remember, you can change. So it's the importance, supreme importance of braiding in the past with the present to assure a different type of future that doesn't repeat the past.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting. Wow. So the call for new judgment. I'm shifting gears here a bit in terms of thinking about hope and this, what you said earlier about the five, the dimensions of diversity and I call it the sacred story. What's your narrative? What's your biology and biography, and how does that inform you? Where are the sources? When you think about your sacred story, you think about your biology and your biography, who you are, what makes you one out of 6 billion people speaking over 6,000 languages on this planet, and there's only one Charlita Shelton. So what? But yet, there's a formula there. When you reflect upon your life and who you are, if you had to say, what is that one thing? And I know there isn't one thing, but I'm going to challenge you right now. What would be that one thing, either from your family, from your community, from organizations you've worked for, with mentors you've had in your life, somebody I know you're well-read and you read from different traditions. I witnessed you at meetings reading scripts, text from other religions and other cultures. What is it about your sacred story that informs you to do this work with a sense of hope? That's my question. That's it right there. I found it.
That's very good, Raina. With a sense of hope. Well, my background is in human development, so that's a combination of sociology, psychology, and anthropology. I have hope in the human being. I love human beings, and I have hope in people and who they are and who they become. And there's two things. And the second thing is, I refuse in my life to ever be a victim to anyone, ever.
Unpack that a little bit for me.
Yes, so I will.
So what you're telling me is, that's interesting. We have no control over what happens to us, but what we have control over is how we react to what happens to us.
That's right.
Is that what you're telling me?
Well, let me give you an example. So, you know, you're a woman in the Marine Corps in the early 1980s, where the ratios of men to women, you know, 1 to 10 or something like that, where it is purely a man's world, controlled by men, tough men, tough ladies too, because we're all Marines. And so I could either walk in there and dealing with an all-male platoon, or a watch, if you will, because I was a communication watch officer, and I could either say that I will allow these males to intimidate me because I'm a woman. Not only am I a woman, I'm a black woman. And I can allow that to happen or not. I'm not going to be a victim to that. I make the decision I'm not going to be a victim. And I think if you have an attitude that you're not going to be bullied around and you're not going to be a victim, you're going to try to look at the positive side of things before the negative. And then if you have an element of confidence, you'll get yourself through it. So I'm happy to say that in my lifetime as a black woman, I would not have faced as many, you know, terrible situations that my sisters faced, possibly because of my attitude, possibly. You know, how did I escape it? Example, one of my sisters there in the Marine Corps, because at that time we're at Camp Lejeune, they call it Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, it's Jacksonville. That's the armpit of the Marine Corps. And back in the day, whether y'all want to hear it or not, there were individuals that could have gone to prison or to jail. And the judge said, either you are going to be in prison or you're going to go into the Marine Corps. You probably heard that before in the Army.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, they chose the Marine Corps. Yeah, yeah. So I have a friend, when I was just a private in Lejeune, came to me crying hysterically. Because one of the males basically told her, he had been bugging her about going out on a date, and she refused. And then finally he says, okay, you have a choice. Either you're going to go out on a date with me, or I'm going to break your jaw. What do you choose? How is she going to escape that? So that's the type of things you did.
Yeah.
Now, was I ever approached in that way?
Yeah.
No.
No. Well, you know, what you're describing is cultural resilience. You know, there's an old line that says, why is it that some people swim in the same waters in which others drowned? And it's what you just said, where the mind goes, the body follows. you're a half full, you know, is the glass half empty or half full? You're a half full person. You're looking at the optimistic. You're looking at the aspirational. And you understand that where the mind goes, the body follows, which is the whole essence of your ability to prevail despite the odds.
Yes.
And I think that's what it's going to take going into the almost next month is September. And we are 6 months into this pandemic. And so in centuries into the racial pandemic, yes. It's going to take a different type of resilience. It's going to take a different type because that's foundational to the sense of hope.
Absolutely.
So thank you for reminding us of what we have forgotten. It's important to have people like you in our community to remind us of who we are and who we can be. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Raymond.
Thank you.